And for the next couple hours, we're going to talk cryptozoology. Lauren Coleman joins us. Talk a little bit about Bigfoot and some other issues next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Well, they say that the birds you see today were the direct result of dinosaurs that began to shrink. And as they got smaller and smaller and smaller, well, they became the birds that you see now. Lauren Coleman with us, cryptozoology. And here he is with a number of stories we're going to talk about. Lauren, what do you think of that? Dinosaurs that shrank.
Oh, well, it makes total sense. I mean, obviously, in prehistoric times, things were larger. There was probably more oxygen supply. When the oxygen supply started becoming lower, and also the gravitational pull was different, then animals miniaturized somewhat. So we see smaller things now, and that dinosaurs are still around. They just happen to be birds.
They sure have. Haven't talked to you in a while. What have you been up to?
Well, I've been busy writing books, getting the museum together, but I also had, I almost died over the winter.
Oh, my God, Lauren. What happened?
A bunch of internal problems, in and out of hospital three times, a couple major operations.
And oh, my God.
Different things like that, but the doctors put me back together like Humpty Dumpty.
Oh, so I love it.
I'm doing better. I'm doing better.
So are you bionic?
No, I'm actually lighter because they took a lot of things out of me. But no cancer was discovered inside of me, so it's all good.
Okay, good. We need you, kid. We need you.
Well, I still feel like I'm 18, so that helps.
Well, good for you. Hey, so, over the last several months, Dr. Brian Sykes came out with his report on the DNA discovery and said that, it doesn't look like it's a Bigfoot. There could be a strange bear up there in the Himalayas, but generally nothing unusual here. What did you think of that?
Well, I think that from the media point of view, and I'm not putting you in with the media, but I think
understand.
The mainstream, even though you're one of the most important media around, the mainstream media really simplified those results too much. On the one hand, the reports of Bigfoot in certain areas as far as these hair samples all turned out to be raccoon and American bear and, horse and different things like that. The very exciting findings from the Himalayan area of this prehistoric Pleistocene bear that exists up there is exciting and incredible news. When you think about it, a bear that has DNA results that matches an archaeological find that's 40,000 years old, and everybody thought that bear was extinct, and in fact calling it a polar bear that actually has brown hair that was crossing over that line from brown bear to a polar bear, that they still exist. That's a relic population that's quite exciting. And in fact, Stiles is going on an expedition next fall, probably in the next few months, to go find it. I mean, it's somewhat of a publicity stunt because he has his book coming out at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't care. I don't care. It's still a great surprise that the finding was found. But the media would have you believe that all of us cryptozoologists are depressed about it and disappointed and, up in arms because he didn't find any primates among the samples. But that was a beginning. It was a beginning because he actually only had a few, dozens samples, and of those he could only get DNA from about 30 or so, and it came back with good results. The other thing we have to remember that just before his study came along, we had the that other study, the publication of the thing online, and the woman from Texas who got all those results. So in some ways, you could actually see that she cleansed the samples out because she came along and she said, "Send me your samples." She got 102 Bigfoot hair samples from people, mostly in North America, that had been saving up their Bigfoot samples until they could have a study like this. So Sykes comes along, asks for samples. After all of those have been cleared out of people's collection, you're going to have an uphill fight.
Well, I'm just glad they're out there doing what they do, Lauren. It's probably just a matter of time. eventually we'll find something. You know, I'm convinced people are one, not lying generally, of course, not those who run around in costumes or try to profit on this, but people are seeing something. I don't know what it is, but they're seeing something.
I totally agree with you. I think that we have to understand that 80% of them may be mistakes and misidentifications, but if you have 19-20% of unexplained in the sighting groups, you still got some unknown animal out there, and that's quite interesting.
So they found this new mammal in Brazil.
Right.
It's kind of like a little horse almost, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a tapir. Tapirs are those animals that you see at the zoo that has a little prehensile nose. It looks like almost a prehistoric elephant in some ways. And they knew that they had four species around the world, you know, in Asia, in Malaysia, and also in South America. All of a sudden, they come across a tribal group of people that say, well, no, we've got one of those here. It's a little more hairy. It's a little more up in the mountains. It's maybe a little bit smaller than the other one that's nearby, but we've got that. And they discovered it and announced that discovery in January. What's incredible is that they backtracked, looked at different records. They found that for 100 years, they had a stuffed one in the American Museum of Natural History. And guess who shot it and put it there? Teddy Roosevelt.
No.
So we have to look in some museums sometimes. And through collections, that's where the Congo peacock, for instance, was discovered in a museum. And then they backtracked and found it in the wild.
So, right under our noses.
Right, exactly.
You know, there's so many other creatures on this planet that they just haven't found yet. It's amazing the amount of life forms that there are on planet Earth, Lauren.
Oh, exactly. I mean, when people come to the museum, the Cryptozoology Museum here in Portland, I say that there's probably about 200 searches for animals larger than cats around the world. Everybody talks about Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster, but there's all of these incredible animals that are out there, and people are looking for them.
And in the sea, too, there's so many other creatures there. I guess that's more difficult to find.
Difficult, but we also find more species there, too.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. And why are they all different? Why are they so strange?
Well, the diversity of animals is, you know, really multi-layered. I think that all you have to do, for instance, is look at giraffes. We've found in the last few years there's six species of giraffes that look exactly alike to us, but their genetic level, the smell, the behavior, the breeding behavior are all different to other giraffes, but we work in a world of macro humans where we think that everything that we see that looks alike is alike, but it's not. There's many different diverse levels.
I think so too. You know, back to Bigfoot, that takes up, in terms of crypto time, how much time, your time and other people?
Oh, it's incredible, George. You know, people love to talk the most about one thing, themselves. So if you look at it in terms of the cryptozoological world, we're really dealing with Bigfoot as the noble savage. It's that wild part of humans that people like to talk about. So 80% of the questions I get at any one time is about Bigfoot, and then right next to, after that is the Yeti. So it's the closer to you get to the human, the more people want to talk about it.
In your opinion, I know you've talked a lot about the Gigantopithecus down in Florida, but what do you think Bigfoot is, Lauren?
Well, I'm in the Paranthropus camp. Paranthropus was a creature that was mostly we know from Africa. Some people call it Australopithecine robustus. The problem we have with Gigantopithecus, and I know Dr. Meldrum and some other people are in the Gigantopithecus camp, they were a rock ape. And they were 10 feet tall. Paranthropus are a little bit shorter. They're more in the 6.5 to 8 foot range. And so they were more human-like. And I think that if you look at Bigfoot as being much more human-like than ape-like, you've got something going there with the possibility we need to look. And I think it's the kind of thing that until you look for it, you're not going to find it. And so people are looking for Gigantopithecus. They're looking for some creature that may be less human-like, although you do have the human-like camp. But I think the Gigantopithecus, we need more fossil evidence, too, to really tell us what that creature looked like.
In terms of intelligence, do you think the creature is smarter, let's say, than a primate? Maybe not as smart as a human?
Well, maybe smarter than some humans I've met.
Yeah, that could be. That could be.
I think that they're pretty smart. I think that also there's different faculties of our mind that need to be explored. And maybe if you're a creature that's out in the woods all the time or in the mountainsides, maybe you actually do extend your telepathic abilities. Maybe you're able to hide in a way, you know, the kind of the mythical ninja-like hiding that some humans talk about. Maybe there are some hominids out there that have increased these abilities because they just concentrate on that as opposed to architecture and building cars and things like that. So they may be very intelligent, and we just can't see that form of intelligence yet.
Are they emotional?
Oh, I think so. And I think that, you know, most animals are more emotional than most people give credit to. I mean, if you look at dolphins, for instance, we know dolphins can actually commit suicide. They can, you know, they can be sad when people leave. That's pretty hard to think about. We're trying to interpret the feelings of an animal that's in water. So if you have a more primate-like creature, then you're going to get feelings from that creature. It's just we don't understand them. And when you really think about it, we're only really looking at the whole life of a creature where we only see them for 4 or 5 minutes. And so that's pretty hard to really understand the whole life cycle of an animal from such small sightings.
What's going on with that project that Jeff Meldrum wanted to undertake, Lauren, where he was going to fly a balloon and, you know, use some infrared or heat sensors?
Yeah, I haven't heard that much about it lately. I know that, pardon me?
Me either. I don't think he did it.
No, I think he still tried to get the funding. And I, you know, Jeff is a very good individual as far as getting out there and talking about things and whipping up the bushes. So I'm sure he's still got something going with that. But he's also, you know, got his irons in a lot of fire. So, and then believe it or not, he then goes back to the university and teaches too. So
that's
let's
right.
hope he's able to carry all of that.
Would you be upset if somebody truly brought in a dead shot Bigfoot?
Well, as I think I've talked about on your program before, I'm in the no kill camp.
Yes, me too.
Of that school, but I'm also a realist, and I know that you're not going to get mainstream science, zoologists, and biologists to really accept the reality of Bigfoot until you have a body, until you have either a captured one, where then we can film it, we can take DNA samples. So if someone shot one and actually brought it in, as opposed to all of these hoaxers that you and I have had to deal with down through the years, mainly are trying to sell DVDs or put their videos up there and then they all fall apart. There's a bunch of charlatans and hucksters out there, and they constantly, it's amazing to me that they keep showing up 2 years later and try it all over again.
And people accept it. Yeah, the media accepts it. You know, they drive around in your van with this thing in there, and they seem to get away with it for a while, and then it collapses. It's amazing.
And then, you know, then they show up again in another shopping center, and they get people to look at a body in an ice break. I think that's the way that some animals are going to be discovered. And my hope is, of course, that one will be hit by a lumber truck, and it'll be an accident, a pure accident, but we'll have a real body.
An accident would be a little better to handle, I think, than one getting shot.
Absolutely. But we have to be realistic. There's some animals that only come to our knowledge because they're bush meat in some marketplaces in Asia or Africa. And that's still a real discovery.
Well,
I mean,
talking about bushmeat, and you are going to Africa, I'm told. Boy, with this Ebola scare, Lauren, I'd be cautious. Are you going to still go?
Well, I don't know if you've heard about it, but a bunch of people, including Meldrum, are putting together a very exclusive conference to study hominids from around the world. It's going to be held in South Africa, so that's a pretty safe
That's a poke away, at least.
But it's going to be in March, and it's combined with the safari to look for certain hominids in the area, as well as some of the megafauna. It's a very exclusive. 100 people are going to be on that, but it's only exclusive in terms of you got to have the money. So we're going to be doing a little fundraising through the museum because we're we could go into the IRS for a while, but we filed as a nonprofit in 2011 at the International Cryptozoology Museum. We just got the letter for it in June, and it took them 3 years to send the letter, but we're 501c3 back to 2011, and we're going to fundraise to get to Africa.
How are you getting there? Tell me it's not a Malaysian Airlines plane. I'm just, jeez.
I think with South Africa involved, it goes through British Airways. So, we can talk about Malaysia Airlines for a while about that. But, that's a whole nother story.
Oh, my God. Did you look into that? You're talking about the one that disappeared?
Yeah, I was in and out of the hospital during that time, but it's amazing with the internet, you can still tweet and people think you're alive, you know, so that's what I was doing from the hotel. I was investigating that and looking at the coincidences, and our old friend Ivan Sanderson from the good old days, he actually looked at these lozenges, as he called them, around the world of where things would turn up missing. Us Fortians, I'm a cryptozoologist, but I'm not averse to looking at strange and weird things.
Sure.
There's these places around the world, and I kept telling people, I don't think this plane is going to be found over land in Asia. I think it's going to be found off the coast of Australia someday, because Ivan Sanderson's little map shows there's this circle there. It's kind of like the Bermuda Triangle of Australia. And then finally, weeks and weeks go by, and then it gets closer and closer, and that's the area they end up looking for. I mean, they never found it, and who knows? I mean, it's in some twilight zone area right now. It was a very mysterious situation. And then we turn around, and here we have Ukraine with another one.
There's some people, Lauren, that have been sending me emails. They are convinced that that plane that was shot down near Ukraine was that Malaysian plane that was missing from March 8th. Now, that's one wild theory.
That is way out there. I mean, I think we have photographs of people that were getting on the plane, each of those planes. They put them on Twitter and Facebook, and you can see their different planes and different things. I mean, people have crazy ideas in the Bigfoot field, too, and we can talk about some of those. But, I don't think that. I think there are coincidences, and some of these coincidences are very hard for humans to understand and comprehend. So they come up with bizarre theories like it's the same plane, which I absolutely don't think so.
Lauren's websites, of course, laurencoleman.com and cryptozoonews.com. They're linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, we're going to talk more about creatures. And then in our final hour with Mr. Coleman, we'll take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Lauren Coleman here, the cryptozoologist. And we'll talk a little bit more of creatures when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Lauren Coleman with us as we talk about Bigfoot and other creatures. Got to talk about those Thunderbird stories too, Lauren, before you're off the air with us tonight. Those things are always fascinating. Back to Bigfoot. So, these people dress up like Bigfoot. They wear costumes. They run across the street. Not very smart, is it?
Not very smart at all. As we know, a little over a year ago, a man up in Montana who was a little inebriated put on a costume, told his friend, film me out in this road, and I'll scare some people. And unfortunately, he got hit and killed. One of the only fatalities that's been recorded. That was up in Montana. I think the saddest part of that story is that he was hit by two different cars, both driven individually by different teenage girls who now have to live with that accident because of this very bad decision on this individual's part.
Oh, my God. So, nightmares for them.
Yeah, nightmares. And, you know, I mean, they didn't get, you know, in trouble as far as most people understood, clearly, but they have to live with that and therapy and all of that stuff. So, I mean, I think the big accident that's going to happen, one of these individuals who are trying to get filmed in the woods, some other hunter in another area is going to see this thing, mistake it for a bear or something else and shoot, and we're going to have a dead individual. I mean, we've had some close calls already, but people are, you know, the whole entertainment value of Bigfoot has increased so incredibly, you know, way beyond our wildest imaginations, that I think that you have this whole hoax area. It's exaggerated by the media, of course, but it's still important. People are still doing it. They're still trying to spook people, and their friends, their enemies, you know, people in the neighborhood. And it's going to get out of hand. It's just going to get out of hand.
Sure is. Sure is. Were you hearing any more stories about Thunderbirds or anything like that?
Well, it's kind of a quiet time for Thunderbirds. There's, of course, we always look to southwest Pennsylvania. That's a good area. There's also the Black Forest of Pennsylvania. It has quite a few reports. Alaska has been giving us good reports where there's, even from the ground, there's been reports of giant birds as large as Piper Cubs airplanes. We've got the problem, though, with more and more drones out there. So people are getting some of those confused with the Thunderbirds, and then they look a little closer, and they're actual drones. We were involved, the museum was actually involved with Lake Champlain expedition over the weekend, and one of the individuals was invited, brought along a drone to go over the lake and try to look for the monster. So we may be getting our monsters confused here. We got to be careful ourselves. So even the investigators may be unfortunately involved in false reports, and then we'll try to clear them up. But Thunderbirds are quite interesting, and you certainly have the folklore there from the West, and working with some Native American tribal groups to look deeper and deeper into their folklore to see if there's anything behind some of those accounts.
Well, yeah, and we know that this incredible story in the Midwest in Alton, Illinois, the Piesaw bird, which was a huge, horrible-looking creature that Native Americans would talk about all the time, Lauren.
Right, and then that's exactly because I grew up in Illinois, so I was right there early on in the 40s where you had reports in the same area from Alton of very gigantic birds. And then we had a wave in 1977 in Logan County in Lawndale where the individual, the little boy, Marlo Lowell, was picked up and carried across his yard. I mean, I talked and interviewed all those people. My brother Jerry was there 2 days after it happened and investigated it. And that was an incredible wave of sightings up and down the state where people would say one of the Thunderbirds would land on top of their trailer, be seen by, army officers and policemen and different things. It was almost as if like the Mothman reports that we got from West Virginia, except it was much, much more grounded in a large, large bird.
You know, I was going to say, do you get any more of those kinds of reports as well, the New Jersey Devil stories, the Mothman stories?
Oh, I'm like you, George. I get stories every day. All the time. I mean, occasionally there's college and high school students that write me and say, you know, Mr. Coleman, please send me everything you know about the Loch Ness Monster or Mothman. But in between those, I get very good sightings. Of course, being on your program, my emails will increase for the next 2 weeks. So that's fine, though. I really like eyewitnesses who know I'm accessible, like you're accessible. And we take these sightings and these eyewitness accounts very seriously. investigate everyone, look into them, see if there's anything there, because you never can tell what one is going to be that one piece of evidence that will really push forward any investigation in the right direction.
I think so, too. Does it seem that most mainstream science just doesn't get involved in this?
Well, very certainly. You have the whole kind of academic group of individuals who feel like it's going to decrease their reputation, or they're going for tenure and they're afraid of what's going to happen. But the other part of it is, because I've been in this now since 1960, so you know, number of years, almost 55 already, and in the beginning, you could not even talk to people in universities about this. I became a professor. I taught for quite a few years. And what I'm seeing is that now people are coming to me, you know, either book signings or investigations I'm doing, and they're saying, you know, I read your book when in 1970, and I'm now a university professor, and I'm really open-minded about this. And I think that's the whole thing is the longer we're in this field, the more popular this field becomes, the more strictly scientific it is also. We actually have people on the inside now. And, George, don't let anybody know that, but there's actually people in the universities and some of these organizations that are on our side, are very open, are looking into this, and even go out on some of the weekend excursions with some of these different groups and really are finding footprints, are getting casts, are talking to Native peoples. And it's really kind of changing around. I think we're not the outcasts as much as we used to think this whole field was.
No, I think it's a pretty darn good field these days, too. And I bet a lot of young kids would love to get into cryptozoology.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that when I was growing up and I was a youngster, everybody around me except for me were interested in dinosaurs. Now we have people, I have 8-year-old kids, I have 5-year-old girls. It's amazing. And then, you know, the 88-year-old young woman who says, you know, has the red hat and brings her red hat group into the museum, and they're all interested in cryptozoology. So young people are using cryptozoology as a gateway to then grow up and become biologists, scientists, paleontologists. As recently as 20 years ago, parents would come to me in a fearful way, and they'd say, my son's interested in cryptozoology. Do you think this will ruin his life? And I honestly had to tell him, I think this is wonderful. You know, as long as you can feel passionate about something and really are into it and, you know, stay with that, go with the passion, you will then open your mind to a whole variety of ways of learning about the world. And that, I've seen that happen over and over again.
Lauren, what's going on in the world of the chupacabra? The only thing I ever hear these days are these, you know, bald dogs that, you know, are probably cross or mutants, not chupacabras by any means. But are you getting any stories?
Very, very few stories from the Caribbean and from Mexico and Brazil. It's really morphed into this thing with the Texas and Mexican reports, and you're exactly right. You know, wait for the summer, and all of a sudden you'll find somebody in their back 40 find this bald, mangy kind of dead creature. You quickly have the television truck show up, and they talk about the chupacabras, and then you get the DNA samples back, and 100% of the time, those turn out to be canids, dogs, wolves, coyotes, foxes that have mange, and that mange has taken their hair off. The animals die. And the unfortunate thing is that these local newspapers are so excited by chupacabras and the chupacabra stories that they're publishing everything that's found on the road. So we're getting reports of mangy raccoons, mangy in Panama. There was a story of a mangy sloth that was found. So it's got to be a media madness sort of thing. It has nothing at all to do with cryptozoology other than the names they're using.
I do want to ask you about this Ebola situation that's happening worldwide that strangely is coming here to roost because two of the victims are being flown here.
Right. Right.
I mean, these people are eating these animals, right, out there in the bush, and these are infected primarily because of the fruit bats that drop fruit that happens to be infected. And then gorillas and, you know, chimpanzees and what have you will eat the fruit. They get sick. And then these people have been eating those animals.
Right. And it is very true that the Ebola epidemic that is waiting to happen in North America is only a plane ride away. So it's very frightening. And, I mean, we don't really know where AIDS and HIV came from. And it seems to really jumped from some of the primates, some of the chimps and stuff like that. So what do we do? How do we guard ourselves against this? I'm not sure, but we have to realize we're in a global world here. We're in one in which if something happens over in some part of Africa, we got to watch our, you know.
Well, and the fact that we're flying them here, I mean, I feel sorry for them. They're in grave condition. Yeah. They'll probably be dead before they even get here. Why bring that here?
I read that story last night about U.S.-sanctioned charter jet. And I was wondering, why aren't they just kept in quarantine in the country where they're being found? I didn't understand that story. I don't understand some of this material that I read about where we fly people all around to put them in another quarantine. I mean, it's almost like the plot of many movies that we've seen.
It's like they want something to happen here. This makes no sense.
World War Z.
They won't tell people where the plane's going to land. They do say that one of the victims is going to go to a hospital in Atlanta. But that's crazy. You know why they won't tell anybody where that plane's landing? Because I think people would storm the runway if they could.
Right. Well, I'm it's dark humor, but I'm glad they're not on the Malaysian Airlines, at least.
Yeah, absolutely, too. Let's talk about that for a second. I mean, you were darn serious about this Bermuda Triangle out there, weren't you?
Yeah, I think that there are different areas around the world where we find a concentration, a statistical concentration of certain planes and ships that disappear. And one of the ones that has always been understudied and underreported is the one off the coast of Australia. And it certainly, if you look back through some of the records, and I did, and I posted on my Twilight Language blog about this, you have a concentration there. And so, some of these areas seem to keep cropping up. The other thing, though, about the whole Malaysian Airlines coincidence is that several months ago, and, I'll give credit where credit's due, a couple bloggers, one named Hunter, another was the Above Top Secret website, they mentioned a whole notion that we should look to the logos on the Malaysian airline, which was a trident, the Neptune fork-like object that held the trident. And then they also mentioned Ukraine and said that, well, the symbol of the country of Ukraine is a trident. And here we had, that was talked about in March, and then here we have a plane from Malaysian Airlines, which has a trident-like logo being shot down in the country of Ukraine. And then one of the first things I noticed, one of the first individuals that they talked about who was on that plane, who was European, but they went to an American university. They went to the University of Indiana. And if you look on the University of Indiana's website, their logo is a trident, because the way the letters go together.
Sure.
And it just kept happening and kept happening. And so what I started noticing was there's a period in July where the ancient Romans used to celebrate Neptune. And during that time period, we had these, and it just happened last weekend, in Venice Beach, California.
The lightning strike, right?
The lightning strike that hit the water, and it killed the young man, unfortunately, the 20-year-old young man.
Injured 13.
Right. And that happened, if you look at the time that happened, it happened about 2:20, 2:45 in the afternoon. That specific time, we have to keep that in our mind. Venice Beach, lightning strike from the sky, 2:45. Okay. Almost immediately, I noticed that there was another story coming out from the East Coast, 2:45 Eastern time, Venice Beach, Florida. A plane comes out of the air and unfortunately lands on a man and his family who's walking along the beach.
Kills him, injures the girl, right?
Injures the girl. The girl died 24 hours later. Her name was Oceana, ocean, a water name. And so you had both Venice Beaches happening and being involved, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast. 2:45 in the afternoon, the danger came from the air, zapped people. Yeah, it was very bizarre, and and there's a lot of connection to both of those Venice Beaches to Neptune kind of places of business, Neptune this, Neptune festivals they have there. So it was highly coincidental, and those kinds of things just kind of pop out to me in my 40 in mind.
Well, and as you know, Lorne, there are no coincidences.
There are no coincidences. Exactly, George. You hit it on the
strange mess. Things happen. What are you working on these days? Still working on the comic series and things?
No, I'm writing I've written 35 books, so.
Yeah, you have.
At this period of my life, I'm taking a couple years and doing a very thoughtful, long book on cryptozoology with some of my thoughts on Bigfoot, too. And then I'm going to take about the next 3 years to write a long book on the Twilight language. So I'm working on those. There is the Lorne Coleman Presents series from Cosmo Books. And this fall, there's 8 new books coming out. Those are old books that are out of print, public domain books. And I write new introductions for them just to get them back so the young cryptozoologists can have those available. Like Ivan Sanderson's A Bondable Snowman, Legend Come to Life. You know, things like that.
Well, that's
it's a fun series.
Those things hooked me when I was a kid. You know, when I would read stories about the Yeti and the Himalayas, I was hooked, and I couldn't get enough of those stories.
And even werewolves, you know, I think there's some hidden truths behind werewolves and things like that. So we're bringing some of those books back.
Those things just always fascinated me. The Creature from the Black Lagoon, all of them. Remember them when we were kids?
Oh, yeah. Did you know the Creature from the Black Lagoon movie is inspired by the discovery of the coelacanth?
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Little known fact. It was such an exciting publicity moment in 1954 when they found the second coelacanth that got all of those movie writers to, well, if it can come back from the ooze of Africa, it can come back from the ooze of the Amazon. And so they created the
coelacanth. Now, that's like a slimy reptile, isn't it?
The coelacanth?
Yeah.
It's a giant, it's that giant fish, the dino fish.
We'll be back in a moment with more with you, Lorne, on Coast to Coast AM.